parsing out Trump's picks today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Trump's choice to lead the EPA is Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt. But is he qualified?
In a sense, Pruitt's well qualified for the job that Donald Trump wants him to do. He's talked about dismantling the EPA.
And retired Marine General John Kelly is Trump's pick for the Department of Homeland Security. One key question facing Kelly is whether to keep the Guantanamo Detention Center open.
I think General Kelly looked at the type of individual who is incarcerated there and said, where are we going to put them if not here?
Plus, Korean couples used to hope for a boy at birth, but not anymore.
It's really no use to have a boy.
The reasons might surprise you. That's all ahead today on The World. Good to have you with us today. The news is coming in pretty fast on Donald Trump's announcements for his cabinet positions. And for the next few minutes, we want to take a look at a couple of key posts. The EPA, whose leader will now determine whether the U.S. plays nice on climate change with the rest of the world or not. And the Homeland Security head, who could ultimately redefine if you see something, say something. We'll also check in on what the new ambassador to China will be dealing with, especially when it comes to Taiwan. We start with the EPA, though. Trump has picked Scott Pruitt for that job. The Oklahoma Attorney General says the jury is still out on the link between pollution and climate change, and he's fought hard against new federal regulations to cut climate pollution. The World's Environment editor Peter Thompson joins me now. This is not a big surprise, Peter. I know Pruitt's name had been floated. Still, what is your quick take on his appointment?
Well, so much for Al Gore. You remember his meeting on Monday with Donald Trump, a surprise meeting in New York. Mm. They talked, of course, about climate change. Gore came out of the meeting calling it a sincere search for areas of common ground. I can't imagine they found much more common ground than that climate change is a phrase. Scott Pruitt really couldn't be further from Al Gore or from the scientific consensus on climate change than anybody Trump could have picked. Trump, of course, also told the New York Times editorial board a couple of weeks ago that he had an open mind on climate change, but this pick clearly indicates a return to his pre-election form on the issue, in which he's repeatedly called climate change a hoax, the EPA's efforts to rein in carbon emissions, an attack on American business and jobs.
So we know that Scott Pruitt is Oklahoma's attorney general. His training is in political science and law. He's got no formal background in environmental science, policy, or law. Why is he qualified to run the EPA?
Well, I mean, Trump himself made his own lack of expertise on a whole range of policy questions something of a virtue in his campaign. So it's really kind of in line with his anti-Washington, anti-government rhetoric. The transition team is touting Pruitt's background in environmental regulation, but it's actually really much more about his opposition to regulation. So in a sense, Pruitt's well qualified for the job that Donald Trump wants him to do. He's talked about dismantling the EPA. He and Pruitt believe that the agency is guilty of massive overreach on a whole lot of fronts. Pruitt is clearly in line with him on those things.
So what is Pruitt's track record on fighting regulation, for example?
Well, to begin with, he's very close to fossil fuel interests, which, of course, are really big in Oklahoma. But he also, most famously, was one of the first state officials out of the block to challenge the EPA's big move on climate change, on the Clean Power Plan, to clean up power plants. That effort succeeded in getting the Clean Power Plan held up in court. You can be pretty sure that under Pruitt and Trump, that's dead.
So bottom line, Peter, what would a wholesale reversal of the EPA's efforts on climate change mean to the global effort to address the crisis?
Well, that, of course, is the really big question. I mean, the signs of really rapid and increasingly dangerous climate change are coming from all around us. Government representatives and activists met in Marrakesh a couple of weeks ago. Mm. Right in the middle of the election, they promised to soldier on in their efforts to fight climate change, to work together, to put pressure on the United States. There's a lot of focus now on what individual cities and states in the U.S. can do to become sort of centers of innovation on climate and energy. But the fact remains that the U.S. is still the second largest climate polluter in the world. So it'll be very hard to keep global emissions below that level that scientists think we need to do to avoid really the worst effects of climate change.
So is Scott Pruitt a done deal as our next EPA chief?
It's likely, but it's not a cinch. Republicans will have a majority of 2 to 4 seats at the runoff coming up this weekend in Louisiana. the Republicans will probably peel off at least one Democrat who would vote to approve Pruitt. That's Joe Manchin of West Virginia, who is very conservative on issues of climate and energy. But there are a few prominent Republicans in the Senate who believe climate change is real. We need to do something about it. Susan Collins of Maine, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, John McCain of Arizona. That's three. Whether they're willing to buck their party on this, I don't know. There might be a few others who could peel off. This is a very stark choice on a very important issue. Certainly the Democrats and the Greens will make a very, very big push to stop this nomination.
The World's Environment editor, Peter Thompson there. The president-elect has also announced his choice to lead the Department of Homeland Security. He's retired Marine General John Kelly. He's the third retired military officer picked by Trump to serve in his incoming administration. Andrew de Grandpre is chief editor at Military Times. He's followed Kelly's career and interviewed the general several times.
General Kelly is a career infantry Marine. He's 66 years old. He spent 45 years in the Marine Corps. He actually did some time on the enlisted side, which makes him something of an anomaly today. He's got a fairly robust diplomatic background. He spent about 2 years on the ground in Iraq. That was right around the time when that war was probably at its peak level of violence. Kelly was essential to brokering something of a truce between Sunni Arabs and Iraqi Shiite militias in Anbar. He was given a couple of high-profile roles in the Pentagon. He served as a senior advisor to both defense secretaries, Robert Gates and Leon Panetta. And then he was moved on to a job within U.S. Northern Command, which, of course, gave him purview of Mexico.
Now, for 3 years, General Kelly oversaw operations at the U.S. military base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, for President Obama. There are Washington insiders who say that General Kelly was the one who put the brakes on Obama's efforts to close Gitmo. Is that true?
He certainly minced no words publicly in saying that he was opposed to closing it. In the times that I spoke with him, you know, he was very clear in saying that if that's indeed the president's order, I'll execute. Mm. But at the same time, I think General Kelly looked at the type of individual who is incarcerated there and said, where are we going to put them if not here?
Donald Trump famously said he wanted to load it up with bad dudes during the campaign. Would General Kelly be on board with filling it up with bad dudes?
My sense is that he would. In the interviews that I've conducted, not only with General Kelly, but with members of Congress who know him well, I think the feeling is generally that the U.S. military is still actively engaged in the war on terrorism and day in and day out is removing potentially bad actors from the battlefield. And those individuals probably possess valuable intelligence. I think the feeling generally is that what better place is there to cull the information that they feel is necessary?
What do we know about what General Kelly feels about immigration, deportations, a registry for Muslims, and, you know, that famous wall that Donald Trump wanted to build?
I think when he looks at the larger immigration issue facing this country, he tends to look through the lens of what can be done at the source of the problem. He is a big proponent of setting the conditions in the countries where people are leaving so that they don't want to leave.
Let me just end with a final question for you, a personal question about General Kelly. He had a son who was fighting in Afghanistan, and 6 years ago, he was killed there in combat. How has that impacted the general?
What he's told me on a number of occasions is that in some ways his grief is very private, but that he is certain that the people who have given their lives for this country were doing what they wanted to do at that time, and they were surrounded by the people they wanted to be surrounded by. I do know, however, that he has reacted somewhat angrily, and I don't think it's that he's angry his son was taken from his family so much as he's angry about the apparent apathy that he sees among the American people at large as it relates to the last 15 years of sustained combat that this country has seen. He often points out that it's only, you know, 1% of this population who has served in the military, and he really has taken aim at what he's called the quote-unquote chattering class that, you know, purports to support the troops but not the war.
Andrew de Grandpre, the chief editor at Military Times, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
Trump has also started sharing his thoughts on diplomacy. This week he said he wanted Iowa Governor Terry Branstad to be his man in China. The news was well received in Beijing, in part because Branstad is on friendly terms with Chinese leader Xi Jinping. That could prove useful for the Trump administration. The president-elect has sparked concerns of a U.S.-China trade war. And last week, Trump frayed some nerves in Beijing by speaking directly with the president of Taiwan, breaking long-standing protocol. The Chinese government protested because it considers Taiwan a renegade province. This week, we've heard many different points of view about this on the show. Today, we turn to Brian Hu. He's a Taiwanese-American and the artistic director of the Pacific Arts Movement in San Diego. So Brian is someone who is steeped in the cultural arena. You can appreciate the power of symbols. When you first heard about that phone call, what did you make of it?
I think I took it as not necessarily as a work of diplomacy, but as just another potential gaffe from Trump. So honestly, I didn't really think about it in terms of how it might be, for instance, advantageous or not to Taiwan. There are a lot of people who are excited that Trump seems to be standing up for Taiwan, or at least naming Taiwan, which is a rare thing to hear in the political arena in the United States. And surely, I think there is reason to be excited for that. But there's also a lot of caution from a lot of Taiwanese Americans who kind of see this move in the context of what Trump has stood for throughout the campaign. Mm. And so they don't quite seem as optimistic.
How do you kind of personally walk that line?
So for me, like, I definitely see Taiwan's current sovereignty as the way to go. I mean, it's worked for many years, and it seems to be allowing for Taiwan to govern itself domestically. I think there's a lot of concern amongst people with family in Taiwan, as I do, that at least we have this right now, so let's hold on to this as long as we can. There are a lot of consequences to ruffling feathers when it comes to trying to advocate urgently for that kind of independence. I think that the conversation about China-Taiwan and its potential in the breaking apart or military conflict kind of hides the elides the possibility of other kinds of political work that needs to happen in Taiwan that the United States can be a part of. For instance, issues of the environment, of labor, of Aboriginal rights, of gender and sexuality in Taiwan, which are hot topics in Taiwan that no one seems to be talking about here in the United States, even though in Taiwan right now, this is what's live and on the ground, and what a lot of the social movements are battling for right now. So I think there are ways in which the United States can potentially be involved without it necessarily being about, we support Taiwan symbolically, we support China symbolically.
Well, here we are at the almost at the end of the week, and a new controversy is now emerging, the possibility that President Tsai Ing-wen of Taiwan might make a transit stop in the U.S., and China said, don't let her do it. The U.S. State Department has said, don't tell us what to do. Let's say this relationship leads to an eventual visit to the U.S. from President Tsai. Would you welcome her to one of your Asian film festivals? Would that be a tough decision?
I would definitely welcome her. I mean, she's somebody who has done a lot for Taiwan. And she's somebody who I think in Taiwanese politics is a very exciting figure. So, I mean, my gut instinct is to say, of course, but I think that I would also try to look for precedent about when Taiwanese leaders are invited to cultural events, kind of soft power sort of events. And in the United States, what have been the consequences and what has been the potential fallout? So I think, again, my gut instinct is to say, sure, why not? And it would be an amazing opportunity. But I think I'm also realistic about what that would mean also for sponsors, for audiences, beyond just how China might respond. And we've shown plenty of films that China should not be happy about that we've done. So I think we'd weigh that against the history of what we've done as well as what other cultural institutions in the United States have done.
Brian Hu is the artistic director of the Pacific Arts Movement in San Diego. Thanks for being with us, Brian.
Thank you, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, or is it? How do you really know what we say is real? That's the kind of question that's coming up a lot in this post-factual age. Trust in the mainstream media is low, and so is much of the news we see on social media. It's false or distorted. Some would even say we're in a new age of yellow journalism. So let's take a moment to review the history of yellow journalism in this country with our history guy, Chris Wolf. What is yellow journalism, first of all, Chris?
Well, here's an example. American journalism is dead, Marco. Its bleeding corpse was found twitching in the gutter on lamestream Media Avenue. Fanatics were seen dancing nearby and defiling the body. Those are the key elements, Marco. A sensationalized banner headline, then a short, weak story full of lurid detail that's more imagination or distortion of reality than solid reporting. If it bleeds, it leads. In other words, any journalism that treats news in an unprofessional or unethical manner. You could think in the last election cycle of any of the unfiltered reporting of any of the falsehoods put out by candidate Trump about Benghazi or blaming Hillary Clinton for Syria or things about the Clinton Foundation, and on the other side of Trump ties to Russia, the Pope endorsing Trump, Pizzagate, all those kinds of things.
Mm. Do you have some real examples from the history of yellow journalism?
Well, perhaps the one that most impacted history was the one that started the war with Spain in 1898. The New York Journal on February 17th of that year ran the headline, "Destruction of the warship Maine was the work of an enemy." This was a U.S. battleship that blew up in Havana Harbor, and the sensationalism like that drove public opinion, which drove Congress to declare war on Spain.
That newspaper was run by William Randolph Hearst, correct?
That's right, Marco. We're talking the golden age of yellow journalism, when the phrase was coined in the 1890s by the editor-in-chief of the New York Post, a guy called Lawrence Godkin. Mm. He coined the term, apparently, and we're not really sure why he called it yellow journalism. Some people ascribe it to the yellowish hue of the papers in the circulation war between Hearst's New York Journal and Joseph Pulitzer's New York World. Others ascribe it to the Yellow Kid, which was the first cartoon in American newspapers, which was used to dramatize the stories that they had.
So how unusual was yellow journalism at the time when it was this golden age of yellow journalism?
Well, they took sensationalism to new levels. But at that time, and through most of history and in most parts of the world even today, most newspapers and news outlets have an editorial line, an agenda that they're pushing, political ties or a crusade that they think is important. And it was quite unusual for papers at the time to have an independent ethical line. Even ethical so-called newspapers had often a crusading line, like the New York Tribune of Horace Greeley. But you start, the first independent paper was in 1835 with the New York Herald. It was politically independent and set many of the rules for independent newspapers. The New York Times followed in 1851. The Associated Press was founded about the same time. So that was the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. So it's almost like there's a cycle, Marco, to do the history of American journalism in 30 seconds. Early 19th century good, late 19th century bad, 20th century mostly good, 21st century off the rails again.
Yeah, so where did we go wrong in this most recent chapter of yellow journalism, if we can call it that?
Or did we, Marco? That's the big question. There's plenty of good journalists out there. Perhaps the more important question is, when did the business model for journalism fail? People read what they want. And so the temptation is to give people what they want, which is quite often entertainment, so that you find a lot of the drive for circulation and ratings now is following the more populist line, and serious reporting, which is expensive, gets left behind. I'd also add one more comment, which is using my immigrant outsider hat for a moment, looking in and say there's been this sustained campaign from the right to denigrate serious news for the last 15 or 20 years. I mean, just as an outsider, you're looking in and you can't help but see it. It's just an observation. It's not a comment. The motives are a mystery to me, but the effect is the same, that a lot of people have, as a result, lost their trust in the media.
The world's one-man history desk, Chris Wolf, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
Pakistan lost a beloved voice yesterday. Singer Junaid Jamshed was among 47 people killed in a plane crash north of Islamabad. Jamshed rose to fame in the 1980s as the leader of a pop rock band called Vital Signs, and he was an inspiration for many musicians in Pakistan today. One of them is Rutaba Yaqub. We had her on the show a while back. Today I asked her to tell us what Junaid Jamshed meant to her.
He was basically the person who inspired me to do music, and he was the guy who basically made me believe that music can live in Pakistan and there's still hope for the industry in Pakistan.
What was it about his career, his music, that kind of inspired you that way?
I think it was the courage of actually doing music in Pakistan, because Junaid Jamshed, along with his other band members from the band Vital Signs, they were the very first boy band of Pakistan who started doing pop rock music. That's basically how every single musician of Pakistan got inspired to pursue it as a career.
I mean, Pakistan has music. I mean, some great musical traditions, the Sufi Qawwali tradition. But in terms of pop music, remind us how pop music is viewed in Pakistan and kind of what risks Jamshed was taking by making that kind of music.
It wasn't about the risk. It was more about the innovation, and because they were great musicians in Pakistan. They came from Pakistan. They were people like Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, who were amazing, amazing vocalists. Mm. But Junaid Jamshed, along with his band members, he basically started doing a different kind of music, introduced prop rock into Pakistan, which nobody else was doing. And I think it was a brilliant, brilliant thing to do.
And yet Jamshed abandoned his music career, joined a conservative Islamic movement. What was that like for his fans? What was it like for you when you learned that?
I was really sad about the fact that he won't be doing music anymore. Mm. But, you know, whatever he chooses for his life, whatever he wants to do, it's his own choice. I don't really have any opinion on that. But it was sad for a lot of his fans who loved his music.
So today in Pakistan, how are people remembering Jamshed? Is his music the only thing on any radio station you dial into?
Yeah. Actually, it's the only thing that I hear.
Have you found yourself singing any of your favorite tunes of his today?
Yeah, I did actually. The night I heard about the incident, I heard this one particular song. It's called Unka Khayal. It's not one of his famous tracks, but I love it. That's the one track that I used to play whenever I wanted to practice the guitar. Mm. So yeah, that's the song I heard.
I'm not going to put you on the spot and have you sing for us, but is there one line in the song that you feel is kind of representative of who Junaid Jamshed was?
I think there was this one line from this other song. It actually read, "Mar bhi jaun to mat rona," and it means that even if I die, don't cry and just remember me by my songs.
Rutaba Yaqub, thanks very much for sharing some of your memories of Junaid Jamshed with us. Really appreciate it.
No worries. Thank you, Marco.
This is The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. Rajiv Surendra remembers when he heard they were making a movie based on the book Life of Pi.
I kind of lost it.
He really wanted the lead role.
Because up until this point, the only parts I could try out for as a young Indian actor in Toronto were for terrorists or math nerds.
Waiting 6 years for a part, that's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Corruption, bribery, extortion, abuse of power, all ingredients for a massive scandal that's consuming South Korean President Park Geun-hye right now. She's facing an impeachment vote tomorrow, and it's not looking good. Jason Strother reports for us often from his base in Seoul, so just remind us of the scandal surrounding President Park. Jason, what's it all about?
Well, it's centered around a decades-long friendship Ms. Park has with a woman named Choi Soon-sil. What is alleged is that Ms. Park gave unprecedented access to this friend. She reportedly shared and had Ms. Che edit government speeches, even weigh in on government policy. South Korean prosecutors who have indicted Ms. Che on corruption charges say that President Park even pressured companies like Samsung, Hyundai to give tens of millions of dollars to this close friend. She ran a couple charities and then ran off with much of that money. But the prosecutors say Ms. Park, who they've named as a criminal accomplice, did pressure these companies to give money, but they can't investigate her. She has refused to participate, and she can't be charged because as a sitting president, she's immune from criminal prosecution.
Now, this friend of President Park's, Che Soon-chil, there's also an interesting background to her story, too. Is she's like a clairvoyant or an astrologer or something?
It's hard to parse what is rumor or not. But what we do know is that her father, he was a clairvoyant, of course. His name was Che Tae-min. Back in the 1970s, he ran basically a cult, something between shamanism, Buddhism, and Christianity. He reached out to the young Park Geun-hye in 1974 after her mother was assassinated by a North Korean sympathizer. You have to remember, President Park's father, Park Chung-hee, was the dictator until his own death in 1979. The cult leader, Mr. Che, said to the young Miss Park that he could speak to her deceased mother. And from that time, a very close friendship with the family ensued.
Is this impeachment vote unprecedented in South Korea?
Actually, no, Marco. In 2004, the current ruling party impeached President Noh Moo-hyun. They say that he used his position as president to influence votes in a parliamentary election at the time. He was stripped of his powers. It went to the Constitutional Court, but the judges said that the impeachment was not constitutional, and President Noh then got his job back.
So possibly that could happen also with Park Geun-hye.
Absolutely.
And what is the buzz among the political class in Seoul about how culpable Park Geun-hye might be?
Well, I mean, if you look at her approval ratings, which are at best 4% right now.
Ouch.
Not good. And millions of South Koreans have taken to the streets over the past several weeks calling for her resignation. And even overnight now, you know, ahead of this impeachment vote, there are protesters camping out by the National Assembly.
Park Geun-hye is the first female president of South Korea. I'm just wondering if that fact alone has upset or saddened some Koreans. And I think of Dilma Rousseff in Brazil, who went through her impeachment proceedings. And there were some who felt that that was partly motivated by sexism.
There's not that kind of sympathy here in Korea for President Park. I mean, even when she ran for office back in 2012, even feminists here, and there aren't a whole lot of South Korean feminists, say that she didn't represent them. She was from the conservative party. Her father was a dictator. They did not feel that President Park was looking out for their interests as women. And that notion has, you know, been with her through her entire presidency. This whole scandal is not about her being a woman. Mm. It's her, what people say, is being a typically corrupt politician.
Reporter Jason Strother in Seoul, thank you for your time.
Thanks a lot, Marco.
Here's another story about change in Korea, but this one is more of an evolution. There's a new saying there: to have two daughters wins you a gold medal. To have two sons, it's a neck medal. That's code for a noose. It didn't used to be this way. Even just a generation ago, Korean couples would go to great lengths to have a son. But there's been a complete turnaround. As Heidi Shin reports, the country's reverence for boys has turned into a slight preference for girls.
That's my aunt. She's almost 80 years old. She remembers the day she gave birth to her fourth daughter. I cried so much, I almost fainted, she says. I couldn't believe I had another daughter. Four daughters. She says, I had to keep having children because I thought I needed a son. It's the only reason I have four kids. Not because I wanted four kids. Korea, traditionally, has been a Confucian society. That meant sons inherited most of the property and carried on the family name. So in my aunt's generation, there are plenty of families with multiple daughters, then finally a son. But when ultrasound technology was introduced to Korea in the late 80s, suddenly far fewer girls were born. So many people aborted babies back then, my aunt says. A few months in, when they could tell it was a girl, they'd get an abortion. The consequences were seen years later when their surviving sons grew up. In rural Korea, there weren't enough women to marry, so men turned to foreign mail-order brides. But fast forward 25 years, things have changed. Many new Korean parents would prefer daughters. Here's my cousin Sayoung from the other side of the family. She was thrilled to learn she was having a girl.
남자는 키워봤자 소용이 없어요.
it's really no use to have a boy.
They just grew up to leave you and take care of their wives, she says. In the past, you needed a son to carry out Buddhist rituals, to worship your ancestors. But as people are living longer, they're less concerned about being honored after death and more concerned about being cared for while alive. As it turns out, they say, daughters are better for this than sons.
Of course, Mia. I don't expect my brother to live close to my mom when he gets married. He always says that he's going to go somewhere else near his wife's family. So that's a new trend.
In the past, your oldest son and his wife would live with you. But that's no longer the case. Sons are moving out when they get married, and parents are burdened with buying them new homes. In contrast, women like Sayang are moving closer to their aging parents. Since daycare options are limited, she depends on her mom for childcare.
Now that most of the women are working and they need a support, so if they need a support, they want to get it from their mom's side versus in-laws, right?
And her parents now have an adult daughter nearby to help them out with things like hospital visits and finances, especially now since more elderly are living alone. In 2016, women have the means to do this. Girls are outperforming boys in school and getting better entry-level jobs. Laws have changed too, allowing sons and daughters to inherit equally from their parents. And now doctors aren't permitted to tell patients the gender of a child until late in the second trimester, when an abortion is much less likely. So in 2016, the ratio of boys born in South Korea compared to girls is back to normal. As for my cousin Sayang, she's grateful for her 2-year-old daughter and doesn't plan on having more.
I was so relieved that I don't have to have a second baby. I think I've got what I want.
Her friends with sons, though, they still talk about trying for a daughter, but worry about the prospects of having another boy.
That'll be a disaster, they said.
My elderly aunt gathers with friends at a community center. They talk about their daughters and the careers they wished they'd had. And they brag about the kids they raised, their sons and their daughters. My aunt says, of course I was disappointed then, but now I think, maybe I did a good job having those girls. My daughters, they know my heart, so I'm not lonely. But Korea can still be a hard place for women, they admit. There's the pressure to be beautiful, to get plastic surgery. Harassment is common, and women don't get promoted at work the way men do. So when it comes to grandchildren, I ask, do you have a preference for granddaughters or grandsons? Well, it turns out, many young couples are choosing to have just one kid or to be child-free. So most grandparents, they're grateful to have any grandchild at all. For The World, Heidi Shin, Seoul, South Korea.
We had comedian Trevor Noah on the show recently. The Daily Show host gave us his take on Donald Trump's election, and he told us about growing up mixed race in South Africa.
In the face of misogyny or in the face of racism, you are reminded of the side that you are on, whether you choose it willingly or not.
If you missed that, have a listen at PRI.org. Since then, Noah has been both praised and criticized for having conservative commentator Tommy Lahren on The Daily Show. Back in 2014, when Noah came to the U.S., many wondered how he'd deal with the complexities of politics and race in America. Would his experience in South Africa help him better understand what's happening here or not? Tomi Obaro thinks not. Her recent essay for BuzzFeed is titled, "Trevor Noah Still Doesn't Get It."
He doesn't really understand how racism in America functions. He's very naive. You can see this in his recent segments on The Daily Show and also in the op-ed he wrote for The New York Times on Monday. Towards the end, he basically says that the oppressed and the oppressors need to sit at the dining room table and hash it out. And the way that he speaks in platitudes, it just sort of demonstrates the naivete about the way that racism, especially after this election, has represented itself.
What is so inherently wrong about kind of saying we need to sit down to try to understand the other side?
I mean, there's nothing wrong with trying to understand the other side. I think it's a matter of sometimes it lowers the stakes. It makes it seem as if racism is just a matter or white supremacy or just all the various ways in which white supremacy functions in this country. It makes it seem as if it's just a matter of misunderstanding when it's actually dangerous and quite literally deadly. And so when he invites someone like Tommy Lahren on her show who says that the Black Lives Matters movement is equivalent to the KKK and says that black men are 18 times more likely to shoot at the police.
A black man is 18.5 times more likely to shoot a police officer than a police officer is to shoot a black man. Those are statistics no one wants to talk about.
Here's the thing. Let me ask you this then. If you say, as you said when you walked out, I'm not as mean as people think I am, I'm not the person that people think I am, what do you wish people would understand about you that are in another bubble? What do you wish people would understand about you on the other side?
And he doesn't challenge that false claim. I mean, he's literally putting people's lives in danger.
Trevor Noah did get praise for his measured response to Tommy Lahren and also his ability to kind of untwist her logic. You don't give him any points
really
for
think
that?
He did. I don't really think he did untwist her logic. And I think it's what's interesting is where the praise is coming from. There's this professor slash journalist, I think his name is David Dennis Jr., who wrote a piece on Medium. He was talking, and I think the head was pretty blunt. It was something essentially that said that white people are praising Trevor Noah a little bit too much. Mm. For them, that they can see the ways in which him sitting with Tommy Lahren and saying like, oh, so what do you do at a traffic light if you don't see color? They think it's funny.
I don't see color. I go after Hillary Clinton and she's white as they come.
You don't see color. So what do you do at a traffic light?
But for black people who are aware of her rhetoric, it's harmful. And the fact that he seems to assume that it's kind of a joke and that, you know, gives her cupcakes the next day. And it just feels like he's trivializing something that's very serious.
Do you not find it useful to have an outsider perspective on race in America?
In some ways, you could say that I have an outsider perspective on race in America as an Nigerian American.
Yeah.
I moved to America when I was 11. And so there was a degree in which I was very naive at first and I had to learn. And then I did. And then I read books. And then I began to realize that aside from slavery, just the ways in which Jim Crow and redlining and all these factors that have contributed to creating, in some ways, like a permanent underclass among black people in this country.
Mm.
So I don't think there's anything inherently wrong. And in some ways, it can be useful and it is refreshing. And I do think that there are aspects of Trevor Noah's comedy where he is sort of fighting back against stereotypes people have about Africa at large. He brings that nuance. But then when he talks about African-Americans, he can just sort of end up veering into stereotypes.
What would you like to hear Trevor Noah do, like in terms of comedy? How would you like to hear him kind of address the age of Trump?
I would like him to listen more, not just to capitulate to this idea that we need to bring in people who spew hateful rhetoric and listen to what they say and give them a platform. I think I would like him to listen more to black Americans in this country, especially because, like, with the cancellation of The Nightly Show and with Jessica Williams leaving The Daily Show, in some ways,
yeah.
He is essentially, like, the only black person doing the late-night comedy political circuit. And with that, you know, for better and for worse, it comes with a great deal of responsibility. And it's a little presumptuous to assume that because he's a biracial South African, he can come in and sort of inherently know the answers, or to act as if because of what he experienced in South Africa, that directly translates to how race works in America now.
Tomi Obaro with BuzzFeed, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. The novel Life of Pi changed Rajiv Surendra's life. He's an actor, born and raised in Toronto, and he first read Life of Pi years ago while working on the set of Mean Girls. He found he had a lot in common with Pi. Like the protagonist, Surendra was Tamil, lived near a zoo, and was fascinated with religion. What he didn't know is that the book by Jan Martel would also send him on a journey that would end with a huge disappointment. He chronicles that in his new book, Elephants in My Backyard. I asked Surendra what went through his mind when he first finished reading Life of Pi.
It was a beautifully written story, and I felt like it was a story that had been written about my life in a way. And then the following week, I found out that they were taking that book and turning it into a film. And I kind of lost it because up until this point, the only parts I could try out for as a young Indian actor in Toronto were for terrorists or like math nerds. That's where we were at that point in the movie game. So I never imagined being able to audition for a starring role in a major Hollywood movie. I just thought that the opportunity would never present itself. And then here it was. And it almost seemed too good to be true. It almost seemed like this part was, there was no one else that was more suited for this part than I was.
Mm. And you wanted to be Pi in the movie. And this wasn't kind of totally out of left field. You had done some acting before. You were just talking about being on the set of Mean Girls. And just to remind our listeners who've seen Mean Girls, this is a bit where you are in the role of Kevin G. Here we go.
Yo, yo, yo. All you sucker MCs ain't got nothing on me. From my grades to my lines, you can't touch Kevin G. I'm a mathlete, so nerd isn't bird, but forget what you heard. I'm like James Bond the Third. Shaking, not stirred, I'm Kevin Apoor. The G is silent when I sneak in your door. Make love to your woman on the bathroom floor. I don't play like Shaggy, you'll know it was me. Cause the next time you see her, she'd be like, Kevin G.
Thank you, Kevin, that's enough.
Yeah, speaking of math nerds, there you go. Kevin G's rap from Mean Girls.
Yeah.
All right. So tell us what happened to your dream to be Pi in the movie version of Life of Pi.
Well, they were supposed to go into production of Life of Pi, the movie, about 6 months after Mean Girls came out. And I thought, you know, I'm going to jump right in. I'm going to get this part. And I felt like I needed to do a bit of research. So I dropped out of college and flew to South India, to Pondicherry, where the book takes place. I spent a couple of months at the boys' school that Pi attends in the book. And then I came back to Toronto and found out that the movie had been put on hold, that M. Night Shyamalan didn't really know how to adapt this book to screen, and the studio was searching for a new director. This was a pattern that continued for 6 long years.
Wow.
And
you just held out, huh?
Well, I felt like I had jumped in, and I had invested so much already that there was no turning back.
Well, just for anybody who hasn't seen or knows the novel Life of Pi, a family is shipwrecked. The boy is the only survivor, lives this uneasy, very weird life with a tiger on a rowboat, and he survives. So you wanted to be that boy. When did you find out whether you had the part or not?
Well, at the end of 6 years, the book was now in the hands of the third director attached to the movie adaptation, Ang Lee, was set to direct the movie,
right.
And it seemed like it was going to happen. So I met his casting director here in New York. She really liked me. She was very moved by all of the work that I had done thus far to try to get the part, and she said, you know, it'll only be a matter of time before you're seeing me again in front of Aang. Mm. And so I waited a little longer, and then I got an email from Jan Martel saying that he was very sorry to be the bearer of bad news, but they cast a schoolboy in India as Pi, and apparently Ang Lee did not want an actor. He wanted the naivete and innocence of a real Indian schoolboy. So that dream was sort of crushed in an instant when I read those words in Yan's email.
What was your reaction to that news? I mean, how did you feel after
6 years? I didn't know at the time what it was. I just remember not crying and not feeling anything, almost just feeling numb and closing my laptop and taking the dog out for a walk is what happened that day. It took me about a year to process what had happened, and that's when I felt the pain of losing out on this part.
Another thing I wanted to ask you is, you know, Hollywood often turns to the same old faces from central casting. Were you kind of happy that Ang Lee went for this unknown boy from India?
Initially, no, because it wasn't me. But you know, when I was doing research in India, I hung out with these 16-year-old Indian kids, and I thought to myself a few times, you know, they could just come here and hire one of these kids to play the part. And ironically, that's what ended up happening.
Rajiv, final question. Did you like Life of Pi?
I did. It was a story that had become very close to me, and as I said, it really warmed my heart to finally just see it on the screen.
Rajiv Surendra is the author of Elephants in My Backyard. Really great to meet you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Marco. Thanks for having me.
Following a dream. That's what singer Kati was doing when she moved from her native Cape Verde to Portugal, and it seems to have paid off. This year she put out her first solo album. We caught up with Kati recently and asked her to pick a track from the album and tell us about it. Jamba busca vida.
I'm choosing Caminho, which is the title of the album, because it's a song that talks about immigration and it's the reality of the people of Cape Verde. We immigrate a lot, we risk and go after our dreams. So this music talks about that. I am an immigrant myself because I live in Portugal and I have a lot of family over the world, and I think we are here in this world, we should all get together, and that makes us all stronger. I think with music you can spread the message, and it's so important that you talk about things that matters. I talk about a lot about peace of mind. If you're in peace with yourself, you'll be in peace with the world.
That's Cape Verdean singer Kadi telling us about the title track from her new album, Caminho. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.